one survey, the only bad survey, they were giving it to people that were in very bad shape. They were very old, almost dead. It was a Trump enemy statement.
A dust-up over President Trump's medication and the larger U.S. role in the WHO. It's Thursday, May 21st, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Doug Bernard in Washington. Also today, helping those in Asia who need it the most and putting those old graduation gowns to good use. We'll have that and much more on today's VOA Asia. President Donald Trump is doubling down on his decision to take a controversial drug despite scant evidence that the anti-malaria drug is effective at stopping infection or cures patients with the coronavirus. On another front, the president is pushing forward with his threat to permanently withdraw funding from the World Health Organization. White House correspondent Patsy Wittakuswara reports.
President Donald Trump, who reportedly has tested negative for the coronavirus, defended his decision to take hydroxychloroquine. He said he has been taking it for the past 2 weeks and dismissed an unnamed survey about the drug.
If you look at the one survey, the only bad survey, they were giving it to people that were in very bad shape. They were very old, almost dead. It was a Trump enemy statement.
There's little known about the drug's effectiveness in battling the coronavirus, but it could have serious side effects, including heart problems. David Sullivan is a professor of molecular microbiology and immunology at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health.
I would not recommend people just taking it to try to prevent them getting the virus at the present time, because the risks do outweigh the benefits if you're just trying to take it for prevention, unless you're in a randomized clinical trial where you can find the answer.
In the middle of the drug dust-up, President Trump is also pushing ahead with his threat to permanently cut off funding for the World Health Organization, accusing the WHO of allowing China to cover up its part in the coronavirus outbreak.
Basically, they have to clean up their act. They have to do a better job. They have to be much more fair to other countries, including the United States.
As U.S. criticism mounted, WHO member states agreed to an independent probe into the U.N.'s agency's coronavirus response. WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus.
WHO remains fully committed to transparency, accountability, and continuous improvement.
Trump declined to speak at the assembly where Xi Jinping addressed WHO members. The Chinese president said he supported an investigation, but said it should wait until the pandemic is contained. He also announced China will provide $2 billion to help with the COVID-19 response in developing countries. Robert Daly is the director of the Kissinger Institute on China and the United States at the Woodrow Wilson Center.
China is now working with the rest of the WHO as a member, and it can use that inside the tent status and its professed willingness, I think you can question its sincerity, to be part of the investigation. I think we can expect to see China use that insider status to slow walk and limit the investigation going forward, whereas the United States increasingly is placing itself outside of that process.
The U.S. supported the WHO resolution, but objected the call for universal, timely, and equitable access to vaccines, saying the language used would send the wrong message to innovators concerned about intellectual property. Patsy Wittakuswara, VOA News, Washington.
And you can read much more on both of these stories at our website, voanews.com. These are some of the top Asia news stories that you'll find right now on voanews.com. RTHK, the Hong Kong public broadcaster, has suspended a satirical show after a government reprimand. China has rejected blame for the coronavirus pandemic. China also imposed massive tariffs on Australia barley imports, sparking fears of a trade war. You can learn more about these stories and many more by visiting us at voanews.com. Taiwan's president Tsai Ing-wen was sworn in on Wednesday for her second term. Analysts say she is expected to put down the markers on Taiwanese sovereignty, but not cross China's red lines in her inaugural speech. More now from VOA's Tina Cheng.
Taiwan President Tsai Ing-wen was sworn in for her second and final term on Wednesday, making her message loud and clear that Taiwan strongly rejects China's claims of sovereignty over the island.
Both sides have a duty to find a way to coexist over the long term and prevent the intensification of antagonism and differences. I also expect the leader of the other side, China, to take up equal responsibility to stabilize the long-term development of cross-strait relations together.
In her speech at Taipei's presidential palace, Tsai said Taiwan could not accept becoming part of China under its one-country, two-systems offer, which is supposed to guarantee autonomy. But Tsai called for talks with China so that both sides could coexist. Tsai led Taiwan's Democratic Progressive Party to a landslide victory in January, vowing to stand up to China. Recently, Taiwan has also accused China of keeping it out of the World Health Organization. And during her speech, Tsai said Taiwan would continue seeking active participation in international bodies.
Over the next 4 years, we will continue to fight for our participation in international organizations, strengthen mutually beneficial cooperation with our allies, and bolster ties with the United States, Japan, Europe, and other like-minded countries.
U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo congratulated Tsai on Tuesday, praising her, quote, courage and vision in leading Taiwan's vibrant democracy. Meanwhile, China's Taiwan Affairs Office said on Wednesday that China would not tolerate any talks about Taiwan's independence.
This news update from VOA Asia. Cyclone Amphan has blown heavy rains and strong winds into coastal India and Bangladesh on Wednesday after more than 2.6 million people were moved to shelters in a frantic evacuation made more challenging by the coronavirus. Much more on this story available at Facebook and at voanews.com. The novel coronavirus continues to grip many parts of the world, already coping with violence and conflict. Doctors Without Borders has been providing health care in many of these regions, including at a hospital in Kabul, Afghanistan, where one of their midwives died in an attack on a maternity ward that killed mothers and newborns. In this interview with International Edition's Lori London, Doctors Without Borders USA Executive Director Avril Benoit talks about some of the other places of rising concern, particularly in the Middle East and Asia, where coronavirus cases are adding another challenge to these already difficult circumstances.
You all are sort of tracking hotspots and moving as needed, given that this is a moving, evolving situation?
The international and subnational travel restrictions actually make it very difficult for us to move the specialist teams from A to B, but we are managing. It's also sometimes difficult to get the cargo shipments in for the personal protective equipment and other medical supplies that would be necessary. Despite those obstacles, we are managing to maintain a fairly flexible approach to these emergency operations.
Are there any particular places around the world, whether it be a country in Africa or the Middle East, that you are seeing a pattern of growing concern that this virus is just beginning to be known how severe it might be?
We look at the models. We look at the reports, which are consolidated by the World Health Organization. And what we are seeing in Afghanistan is quite a concern to us. As you know, we had recently a horrific attack on the maternity ward in a hospital we've been supporting in Kabul for many years. They came in and specifically sought to kill the mothers and newborn children. The violence is absolutely shocking. In that environment, we also know, because of our work in parts of Afghanistan, that there's very little testing capacity. In those areas close to Iran, which has had a very high burden of COVID-19, we've also been striving to mobilize extra support. So you can imagine the difficulty of thinking, well, are we being targeted here? Are the mothers we're looking after here being targeted, assassinated in cold blood, just as they're delivering babies, at a time when we're also trying to stop a pandemic from wreaking havoc in the country? The complexity of being able to work in an environment like that has us extremely concerned. And we call on everyone who is holding a gun in those kind of regions to please spare the population that is going through enough with this pandemic, to try to certainly spare the health structures. They should be not targets for the kind of violence in wartime that we've seen far too often. We need to be able to do our work to save people and to stop this pandemic. And so that, I would say, is a huge concern of ours. It's a concern of anyone who is a doctor, a nurse, a caregiver in a place where this additional burden of conflict, the violence that sends people running and fleeing and crowding and hiding, this is no way to be able to stop a pandemic in regions like that.
Were any of your people wounded or killed in that attack?
Yeah, yes. From what we hear already, one of our midwives was killed. It's one of the deadliest attacks we've ever experienced. At this point, the official numbers are indicating that 24 people were killed. A large majority of them were patients, were women.
Why would they target mothers giving birth?
Can you imagine? It's absolutely shocking. That's the madness of war. I mean, there's just no explaining this.
That was Doctors Without Borders USA Executive Director Avril Benoit speaking with VOA's Lori London.
VOA Asia is on Twitter. Follow us at VOA Asia for developing stories in Asia, perhaps close to you. Our Twitter feed also has updates on programs you can hear and see, with links to easily find them. VOA Asia Twitter, we're always online for you.
This news update from VOA Asia. Pakistani officials say a roadside bombing of a military convoy and a separate clash with militants in southwestern Baluchistan province have killed at least 7 troops and a civilian. Much more available on this story and others on Instagram and at our website, voanews.com. Adjusting to online education in this time of pandemic can be tough. For deaf and hard of hearing students and educators, it's probably even more so. Now, teachers are creating their own online resources in American Sign Language to overcome this difficult time. VOA's Calla Yu has more.
As most schools transition to online education during the pandemic, deaf and hard of hearing students and educators at Gallaudet University are facing some challenges.
ASL is in 3D, where we have our facial expressions and body language that uses space to convey and emphasize concepts. So the online teaching and learning, ASL becomes 2D from time to time. It creates a little bit more of a struggle because students can't really see all of the facial expressions.
Not only that, the lack of online educational materials has also been a challenge for students and educators using American Sign Language. Some teachers had to make videos on their own.
It was frustrating too. The first 2 weeks of being online, I worked day and night on developing all this, over weekends too. So a lot of the faculty members, educators, are making their own resources, because what organizations or companies that are providing these apps without captioning and no ASL, we can't access. So no, there isn't anything out there. And that's one of the things that we're struggling with right now.
Deaf and hard of hearing children are also in desperate need for ASL educational materials. Head of Gallaudet University's Digital Education Lab, Melissa Mauskun, is also a parent of a deaf child. She finds the English caption on most apps too complicated for her 7-year-old son.
And so my deaf son has to ask me what the apps say. And so then I will read the captioning and sign it to him. So we really have to develop more resources for deaf children that are presented in American Sign Language, fully accessible to the young deaf emergent reader. So that has become more and more apparent to me in this pandemic, that there's a huge gap.
Mauskun and her team developed a new free storybook app, providing bilingual storytelling and arts and crafts activities for younger children. 1,500 families have signed up in the past 2 months. However, on-campus experiences and interactions with teachers and peers are crucial for deaf and hard of hearing students, especially for those whose hearing parents don't know how to sign. They are at risk of being isolated and losing motivations to learn.
Hearing children have immediate access to information, whereas very often deaf children don't, not surrounded and inundated by information and resources. But if we're able to work together to create something for deaf children, then we're able to make up for the lack of resources that they experience.
On Boston University's online platform, Deaf Education Library, educators have shared over 600 videos for early childhood to high school education, all in ASL. However, for students and educators in this unprecedented time, there is still a lot more to be done.
I think this will help us understand what it means to have an online learning experience. And especially my view for younger children, you know, wow, they are so resilient. And I think that digital learning should be just one of many options that they have. That they get support they have access to, but that that's not their main approach to learning.
Kelly Yu for VOA News, Washington, D.C.
How dangerous is COVID-19? 80% of the cases are said to be mild. Young and healthy people are at a relatively low risk. Elderly and people with serious health conditions are at risk of fatality. If you have a cough, fever, and shortness of breath, contact a doctor and stay away from other people. For more information, visit the websites at the World Health Organization and the U.S. Centers for Disease and Control. A message from your friends at VOA Asia.
After the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommended contingency and crisis strategies for frontline healthcare workers in late March, there was an immediate shortage of protective gear in hospitals. A family in Maryland is now doing their part by making face shields at home and donating them not only to healthcare workers they know, but also where it is much needed, hospitals in New York City. VOA's Saqib ul Islam has their story.
A dot of hot glue on each side.
10th grader Ira and her older sister Amal are making these face shields on 3D printers at home.
My dad's a doctor, and so he has to see like his patients all the time, and even some of his colleagues were infected by the coronavirus, so I wanted to at least do something to contribute.
Inspired by the robotics class and love of their father, the Hussein sisters bought a 3D printer from their pocket money. And once they started printing face shields and donating to individuals, demand and help increased.
That time I posted on Facebook and family and friends, they donated. So we bought two more printers.
According to Ira, one face shield takes almost 4 hours to print. And their three printers are continuously printing face shields according to CDC guidelines. Hussein family says they have donated about 100 of these shields to the hospitals in New York and Maryland. New York's Jamaica Hospital Medical Center is one hospital where these homemade face shields are being used by frontline healthcare workers.
Initiatives like this are very important to us for two reasons. One, because our staff will be well protected when treating patients who have COVID-19. And two, it shows our staff that people in the community, both far and wide, are thinking about them during this pandemic.
Their father is proud to hear this.
We wanted to instill this spirit for them to make an active contribution, be aware of the seriousness of this in terms of how even in small steps they can make a contribution.
And the sisters do understand it.
When the doctors have come to our house to pick up the face shields, they just express their gratitude and they say thank you very much. It was really humbling and we felt really honored because I feel they're doing much more for us than we're doing for them.
The Hussein family plans to continue printing face shields as long as there is demand. Saqibul Islam, VOA News, Fulton, Maryland.
This is Science in a Minute.
A number of studies have previously linked the consumption of sugary drinks with increased risks of death from a wide range of causes. A new study published in the Journal of the American Heart Association provides evidence that drinking around 355 milliliters of sugary drinks more than once a day is connected to a couple of factors that can contribute to cardiovascular disease. The study finds that among middle-aged to older adults, drinking sugar-sweetened beverages can lower levels of HDL or good cholesterol, which helps remove bad cholesterol from the bloodstream, while increasing levels of triglycerides, another type of fat found in the blood. The study also shows that drinking low-calorie sweetened beverages or up to 355 milliliters of 100% fruit juice every day wasn't associated with increased risks or adverse effects of elevated fats and cholesterol in the bloodstream. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Concerns over the coronavirus have changed the ways people socialize, shop, and work. The pandemic also robbed many students of big events during their graduating year in school, canceling dances, sporting events, and even commencement. VOA's Arash Arabisadi brings us this good news story of one physician's assistant in Vermont who is urging students to donate their graduation gowns to help healthcare workers battling COVID-19.
Nearly 4 million graduates in the United States will this year be denied a rite of passage due to social distancing and concerns over the coronavirus pandemic. It turns out their otherwise wasted graduation gowns could actually save lives.
As an emergency medicine physician assistant treating COVID-19 patients, I have witnessed firsthand the devastating effects both here in our community and beyond. I've heard the horror stories of healthcare workers lacking the personal protective equipment to keep safe.
Health worker Nathaniel Moore recently founded the charity Gowns for Good. He's asking graduates to donate their new or used gowns to more than 75,000 frontline responders registered on the site.
I developed Gowns for Good with the purpose to protect healthcare workers by upcycling graduation gowns. The gowns are more effective than other alternative measures of PPE, given their length, their sleeves, and their easy donning with zippered access.
Moore says gowns worn backwards meet CDC requirements for personal protective equipment, or PPE, by covering critical zones of forearms, chest, stomach, and waistline.
To hear these personal stories of people on the front lines that have nothing, that are begging for gowns, that are begging for any support that we can offer them and as fast as possible. And we're working just as hard as we can to make sure we can spread our story, get people to donate to help those that are reaching out.
Moore says among the 5,600 donations he so far received, some came with heartfelt notes from parents whose children died years ago before having the chance to graduate. The regalia seemed too precious to give away, they wrote, until now, when the gowns could save the lives of those trying to save ours. Arash Arabisadi, VOA News, Washington.
And that is VOA Asia for today. Thank you so much for joining us in these trying times. We'll be back with you again tomorrow. We hope you will as well. And until then, take care and be well.